The Winners Club is the weekly podcast that shares the highlights and insights from some of the most meaningful and impactful conversations from the number one community on Clubhouse, The Winners Club.
Welcome. Jeremy Brand and myself and the team have been warming the room up, but it's delightful to have you here on stage.
Wonderful to be here with you, John, and remember our contacts in the past, Jeremy and Brandon. Hello, and hello to all who have joined us at Clubhouse.
Well, it is tremendous to have you here, and I think we have been sort of warming up the conversation by getting behind the scenes of Jeremy and Brandon's history, by understanding actually their views on how entrepreneurship and entrepreneurs can change the world. But we are really happy to really hand over the mic to you and ask you to give your view of the world that we're now in, perhaps a little bit of insight into your journey and what you think there is still scope for entrepreneurs to continue to have the sort of impact that you champion around the world. So over to you, Sir Ronnie.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you very much, John. Well, like Brandon, I think it was, I started my first business at the age of 26. It became Apex Partners, a big private equity firm today, which manages about $60 billion across the world. And I started off with the birth of venture capital, as luck would have it. And I sensed while I was in the States, actually, at Harvard Business School, a little bit earlier when I was 22 or 23, I sensed that small was going to be beautiful, that technology was going to give an opportunity for small businesses to overtake big ones, really, because they could innovate better. It just seemed to me more logical that a small business could think out of the box and move more swiftly. And of course, it has turned out to be the case. And some of the biggest businesses in the world today were created in the 80s and 90s and 2000s by very young entrepreneurs, many of them dropouts from university. Now, in those days, people didn't realize that technology was going to be so big. A lot of people thought that technology was just going to affect the computer industry. And those who refused to see the arrival of technology were overtaken. So you find IBM overtaken by Apple, by Microsoft, and now Facebook and Google and so many other companies. And today, the same is true of impact. We live at a similar time to my start in venture capital, a time when huge change is about to take place, and it's going to create huge opportunities and also huge threats for those who don't understand what's going on. Basically, John, as I see it, we have three major forces coming together at the moment. We have a change in values, which means that all of us on this call, I suspect, don't want to buy the products of companies that are doing harm or to work for them or to invest in them. And this hasn't been lost on investors who are now channeling $40 trillion or more. Half of all professionally managed assets in the world are now taking impact into account when making investment decisions, which in plain language, John, means that they want to achieve more than profit. They actually want to improve lives and the environment. So we have this massive change of values, which has changed investment flows. And then we have these huge leaps in technology, which enable us to deliver impact globally in ways humanity could never contemplate previously. I'm thinking in terms of machine learning, artificial intelligence, augmented reality, of course, everything that's happening around the genome. And those two forces are being met by a third force, which is going to be, I think, a new one for most people on this call. And that force is the ability of technology to enable us to measure the impacts of companies as we measure their profit. Now, that may sound odd to people. They may think, well, how could you measure the impacts of the company? Well, the truth is they break down into three major impacts. The first and most obvious impact that people think of is the impact from their operations on the environment. The second is probably the impact of their employment. And the third is the impact of their products. And those impacts can be measured on people and on planet, because a huge amount of work has been done and a huge amount of science has been created around measuring things like tons of CO2, differences in gender pay, differences in diversity between companies, the sugar content of products, the fiber, which is negative, obviously, the fiber content, which is positive. So these three forces are coming together to change the way we work and the way we invest. In fact, to change the way our economies operate. Because if you think about it, the search for profit, capitalism, as we call it, has helped us hugely to bring people out of poverty and to create wealth. But we've reached the stage where the consequences on people and the environment are so big, John, that we can no longer cope with them. Governments can't cope with them. And so what's happening is the world is shifting from making decisions on the basis of risk and return to risk, return, and impact. And the impact is being measured in the same way that we're measuring risk. We learned to measure it about 70 years ago when we talk about investment risk. This combination of risk, return, impact creates huge opportunities for entrepreneurs. And Tesla, and I'll close with that, is an example of it, of an entrepreneur who says, I don't just want to enter the automobile industry. I want to shift it away from the pollution of the combustion engine. And you've got entrepreneurs like Elon Musk today who are doing that in areas like health, like fintech, like education, in food products and baby products, and you know, in every sector, basically. So it creates massive entrepreneurial opportunities. And it's a revolution, John, as you said, like the tech revolution before it. And my book, Impact, Reshaping Capitalism to Drive Real Change, which I'm glad to say has just been named the Wall Street Journal bestseller too, covers exactly that.
That's fantastic. So Ronnie, thank you so much for that kickoff to this discussion. I think that really encompasses so much of what so many of us have felt over the years of change. I mean, personally, the work that I do now in my portfolio, I also lead a group of agencies at Omnicom. One of the critical things I keep talking about with our big clients is that they need to look at creating external value in the marketplace for the values that they hold internally. And those values are then created through the products, the services, the way they treat their people, the way they impact on their environment. And I think as you were talking there about the three things fusing together, the way technology will advance our thinking, the way it will increase our traceability for the measuring of impact, fundamentally based around a values-driven business that is about helping either people and or the planet solve those issues, is really where we're seeing a lot of the younger entrepreneurs coming up and people entering business with a real desire to change the world for the better, as opposed to just to make lots of money. And I think exactly. That's a transformation I've seen over the last few years. So Ronnie, if we can come back to you and keep you there, because I'd just like to get some input from Jeremy and Brandon on this, because we've all come to a certain point in our own lives, in our own history, the demise of the Milton Friedman philosophy of it's purely about the shareholder, moving into a stakeholder type era. Jeremy, if I come to you first, perhaps, you've just heard from Sir Ronnie. What's your sort of reflection on what you've just heard?
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, look, it has been a theme for quite some time. And I think 2020 was going to be the year where ESG took this really big bang. Right at the end of 2019, you had BlackRock saying it was repositioning its asset portfolio to focus on impact, and you had the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund announce that it was divesting from oil and gas assets and focusing on impact investing. And it felt like there was going to be a wave of momentum into 2020. And then, of course, the news all shifted to the pandemic, and there was, you know, barely any room in the news flow for anything else. But the desire and the undercurrent is absolutely there, and I will be reading Sir Ronald's book. I haven't done so yet, but congratulations on the Wall Street Journal bestsellers list. And there is definitely that move. I mean, look, the area that I always focus on is the small business community, and the small business community, you know, as Sir Ronald pointed out, is the kind of engine of our economy. Tomorrow's big companies come from small companies, but it's also a bit of a forgotten asset class, because when you do look at all that money that's flowing around, is almost in a parallel economy. The top 500 asset managers in the world are controlling $93 trillion, and really zero of that finds its way into small to medium-sized businesses, apart from perhaps a little bit of venture capital type funding. And yet those small to medium-sized businesses are 50% of GDP in most mature economies, and they're over 90% of the private sector workforce. So if you really want to impact into communities in every town and city, in every country, you know, around the world, you have to support small business, and you have to get capital to flow into small business. And that's really where I've been focusing my time and attention, is trying to make small business effectively an investable asset class, because they create quality employment, they have direct impact in their communities. When it comes to things like CSR, they're incredibly small and nimble and dynamic, so they can change and adapt CSR policies very easily. They don't have the legacy of some of the large companies that, you know, they have to change things. So, you know, for example, MBH Group, the group of companies that we put together, is 26 separate businesses in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, the UK and the US, all collaborating together. And they all have their own ESG policies within them. And the impacts that they're having both globally and in their own communities is really a joy to watch. And it's fascinating. And by giving them this large multinational public company structure, they can also go and punch above their weight, attract better talent, get better supplier contracts, win bigger customers, and do stuff. And I think creating more groups like that, I mean, John, we've talked about B Corps before and the impact that they're having, and grouping those together and how powerful that could be. I think maybe we can stop, you know, small business being this sort of lost asset class, and get people to actually invest in small to medium sized businesses, and bring that money from Wall Street back into Main Street.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, absolutely. On that final point, Jeremy, I would absolutely agree. I mean, the number of ethical driven businesses and younger entrepreneurs coming up now, how they access finance is a critical thing. I want to come to you, Brandon, in a moment. But so, Ronnie, do you have a comment just on that access of finance?
I couldn't agree more with Jeremy. Small and medium sized businesses are going to be crucial in this recovery. In addition to everything that Jeremy has said, if you think about it, a lot of big businesses have learned to streamline their operations and have shed labor. They're not going to hire back. And the only way of driving employment coming out of the COVID pandemic is going to be through small and medium-sized businesses. And actually, the tools of impact investment can attract more capital to these businesses. Many small business owners are part of their communities. They share the views we all share in this conversation about the need to contribute to the community as well as make a profit. So I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so there's some tremendous stuff there. I would also make one more comment on Jeremy's point before I go to Brandon, which is that, you know, frankly, from a CSR perspective, I mean, I championed CSR for well over a decade, but CSR is dead. It's defunct, frankly. Peripheral things, in my view, are nothing to do with having core ethical purpose at the center of why a business exists. And I'm glad Sir Ronnie agrees, otherwise I might be a bit embarrassed by that. But I also sort of tend to say, you know, these ethics and values need to be the preoccupation of everybody, not the occupation of a few CSR specialists. So, Brandon, you've been very patient there, quiet, but you have created in your time extraordinary amount of money, extraordinary amount of asset and value in businesses, etc. You've been listening, obviously, to the conversation, how it's been flowing for a little while now. Could we get your take on this whole shift towards the ethical driven impact of business and entrepreneurs? Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate what Jeremy just talked about, because that's how I pivoted my career. I was a consolidator, you know, a traditional acquire, kind of cram down to create value and synergies and economies of scale and you know, whipping people into work. And it really didn't serve me and it didn't serve them and it wasn't ultimately a successful outcome. So in the early 2000s, I thought to myself, you know, I studied a lot of consolidation theories that on paper should have materialized and came to the conclusion that process and profit isn't actually what drives value, but people do. And so I engineered my reverse consolidation on the concept that if I could lead and guide individual small to mid-sized business owners on how to properly grow scale by aligning their team with the business, aligning their personal, professional, financial, long-term goals, created some technology and taught business owners how to do that. And in the process, we outgrew their peer groups 3.5 to 15 times in value and size. And so sold that business for 77 times EBITDA, $151 million to a public company in Denmark that was doing $1 billion. And we incorporated that globally. And I'm happy to say that it's been 60 months in June and the market value has gone from 1 billion to 4.5. And both the global CEO and CFO and chairman, you know, we have a dynamic relationship. So it was nice to see that you can impact local communities in international markets with similar concepts. And so I rolled this strategy out with Grant Cardone. I partnered with him a couple of years ago and we've already got thousands of businesses. And going to what Jeremy was talking about, you know, the small to mid-sized businesses, they do make up 48% of the GDP and almost 70% of the employment in the U.S. alone. And yet they're only represented 6% on the stock market. So they never really see this expansive value that they can redistribute and pass on to the people that contribute to building that value. And even worse, out of 31.5 million small to mid-sized businesses, two-thirds will fail cyclically every 5 years. And most of them are trapped with less than 15 employees. So to me, if you want to create an impact, you got to do it by aligning the interests of the people with the business objectives in an ethical and moral business that serves others. To me, that's if you can align those elements and then teach people the fundamental skill set to break through the mistakes and the false beliefs and the limited accessibility to technology, strategy, leadership. So that's really my mission, is to bring that to millions of business owners and help them on a micro market, growing them into mature businesses that can break through become the top 2 or 3% of the small and the mid-sized businesses. And so, you know, that's my mission. And when you can take a business owner in a micro market who's struggling and doesn't have access to all the big resources, huge consolidators or conglomerates have, and you can get them to outperform the sector and bring their teams along and reinvest into those communities, it is a magical thing. And it's something it drives me and inspires me every day. So I think what Sir Ronnie Cohen and Jeremy were just discussing is the thing that gets me up every single morning and gets me so excited about helping people break through the failure rates and really excel at creating massive value, but not only for the business owners, but learning that in order for that to happen, they have to bring their people along and provide an aligned success to those people. And when that happens, man, everything is fun.
That's a great insight, Brandon, from your side and your experience. And obviously what's so good about this is that sort of golden thread running through the fact that this is about lifting people, enabling them to create value across their sense. Now, I'm going to come back. Sorry, Brandon, did you want to add something there?
Well, I was just going to say, I will say this, the most excited day I had in my lifetime is instead of raising capital with the last business, I decided to give equity to my customers in exchanging and doing business. And I didn't put any financiers in the middle of any of that. The proudest day I had is when we sold the business, I wired $45 million out to my customers and every one of my employees. And they're the ones that drove the value over 15 years. And for somebody that doesn't have the sense of what that feels like, I can just tell you that it is unbelievably inspiring and empowering. So that's probably the proudest moment of my life.
That's a wonderful story, Brandon. It actually reminds me of somebody some people in the room will know who I'm really privileged to have a great relationship with, Dame Stephanie Shirley or Stevie Shirley. She's now in the UK. She was a pioneer. You, I'm sure you know her, Sir Ronnie.
Please call me Ronnie, everyone. Ronnie.
Okay. I'm very formal being in the Prince, having previously stood with Prince.
Yeah.
But you know who I'm talking about. She was a pioneer in the 60s. Yeah. And she created a female-led business, but basically when she gave equity out in exactly the same way as you described, Brandon, and when she sold her business, there was something like 40 millionaires walked away from that who'd all been women working from home doing this extraordinary coding business for things like Concord, etc. And absolutely it's not something that I've done, but you can imagine how that makes you feel when you've created that transformative impact on people's lives. This is a unique panel and a unique opportunity to learn about entrepreneurship, business, finance from some extraordinary people. And also, of course, follow the Winners Club. Brandon, I want to go and take a bounce off you and then put it into the question. You talked about that international aspect of growing. And when I look at the three of you, of course, you are across the globe. So Brandon, you explained how you're operating globally. Jeremy, you're between Singapore, Dubai, and across the world. Ronnie, you're all over, you're everywhere as well. The question I'm going to ask, and I'm going to come to you first, Ronnie, is do you see national characteristics or national traits that affect the way in which people think about entrepreneurship, think about creating business? I'm less concerned about statutory conditions. I'm thinking more about whether or not there's sort of national traits or how people think about this.
Well, there's been a revolution over the last 50 years, obviously, John, because at the time when I started in the UK in 1972, people could hardly spell the word entrepreneur. And that's not an exaggeration. And in Britain, there was a general feeling that you shouldn't take risks, and if you failed, you'd be doomed to fail, and so on. This is completely transformed now, and I think what is going to be striking about this impact revolution in comparison with the tech revolution is the tech revolution has really been concentrated in the United States and a couple of other places like Israel and parts of the UK, of Germany, France, and China. The impact revolution, which is going to be using technology to deliver profit and impact at the same time, and I'll give an example of what I mean, is going to be widespread across the whole world. Wherever there are people who feel entrepreneurial and there are major issues to tackle. And the combination of rethinking your business model around impact and the capital that is now flowing, we see it first as ESG, environmental, social, and governance capital, which doesn't measure impact, 40 trillion of that. It's turning into impact investment. Impact investment measures the impact created and is a trillion today. I want to give you just a quick example of why if you put on impact spectacles, it's actually a better way to make money and you can be even more successful. So I'm talking to you today from Tel Aviv, where I also have a home. My wife is Israeli, as some of you will know. There's a company here called Orcam, which I talk about in my book, Impact. And Orcam developed a pair of spectacles to help the blind. These are spectacles you put on. They have a little memory stick-like device hanging off the edge, and they whisper into the ear of the wearer the page of the book they're holding. They recognize 300 faces that have previously been registered and stored into them. They can recognize the banknote in your hand. Now, you'd say, wow, that is an amazing venture. 35 million blind people in the world, 250 million more who are visually impaired and who could use this. And I can tell you from speaking to people who've used the device, it transforms their lives. Now, if you put an impact lens on and you say, how can this technology help the maximum number of people in the world? You get a surprising answer. The answer is, what if you provided these spectacles to the 800 million illiterate people in the world? What would that do to improve their lives and their livelihoods and even the economies of their countries or the world economy? 800 million people is a huge number of people to take from being illiterate to being able to read. And so all of a sudden, John, you have a market of 1.1 billion people. And that means you can produce at larger scale, you can make it cheaper, and it begins to turn your venture into something that can be hugely more successful.
That's fantastic, because it gives true sense to scale there, true sense to scale. I should just say I still have difficulty spelling entrepreneur, so I don't think there's any challenge that's changed, particularly with some of us in Britain or elsewhere. And funnily enough, of course, well, not of course, but I grew up with parents and grandparents all had their own businesses, but that was never a word that would be used. They would have considered themselves business owners or shopkeepers or farmers and things like that. Entrepreneurs is, a relatively new word in terms of being something people aspire to now, in contrast. Yeah. But in terms of that global question, Jeremy, in your experience, have you sensed those different attitudes and perspectives from people?
Yeah. It's so funny on that question. Napoleon described us as a nation of shopkeepers and meant it as an insult, which I thought was funny. My parents were entrepreneurs, and growing up, there was only, I think, Anita Roddick and Richard Branson were pretty much the only two entrepreneurs in the UK when I was growing up, or certainly the only ones that were described as entrepreneurs. So the world has definitely changed a huge amount in that respect. But globally, when we're traveling, look, I do deals in the English-speaking kind of common law countries. So we're in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, UK, Canada, a bit of US as well. And certainly within all of those countries, they all have the same thing in common, which is that the SME space is kind of left to rot. So you have startups in all of those places are quite well funded. There's lots of kind of incubators and angel networks and things like that where startups can access capital. There's, obviously huge amounts of funds in private equity that can go into the $100 million plus sort of transactions. And then everything else in the middle is left to rot. If they want to borrow money from the bank, they have to bet their house. Venture capital is not interested unless it's something with marijuana in it or an app or something. And it's just way too small for PE. So this mid-market piece that Brandon and I and Ronnie have all talked about, which is this kind of, rump of the economy, is really left to rot in pretty much every country you go to. Now, obviously, I spend quite a bit of time between Singapore and the UAE, and they're both incredibly dynamic in terms of places to do business and very welcoming of new business and a lot of hunger and activity. I remember going to Asia for the first time in my life in 1997, and I had a telecoms company at the time, and I stepped off the plane in Malaysia and just rang up the three largest telecoms companies, and I met with the CEOs of two of them and another board member in the third one. And I just thought to myself, imagine trying to do that in the UK. Imagine flying to the UK and demanding a meeting with British Telecom, Vodafone and Orange, for example, or EE as it is now, I think, when you're getting off the plane. And it just amazed me how open to business those emerging economies are and how much easier it is to kind of, obviously there's all sorts of other barriers, but how easy it was to get the dialogue started and to get those kind of conversations going. So yeah, I do feel lots of differences around the world when I'm traveling, and lots of different levels of of welcoming him. It was interesting when Ronnie was talking about this idea of, you know, failure being a disaster. That was very much what I felt when I was growing up, is that if you failed, that was a disaster. And of course, when you're an entrepreneur, that's pretty much all you do to start with. I mean, that's how you learn. So, you're not made to feel very, very good about yourself. And then obviously we went through this kind of decade, I think, leading up to about 2008, where if you were successful, they hated you too. So it was almost like the only thing that was celebrated was mediocrity. If you were if you were a failure, you were terrible. And if you were successful, you were terrible. And that was one of the things I loved about going to Singapore, because in Singapore, people would ask you what you did and they'd be fascinated by it and they'd be interested. There wasn't this envy or sort of jealousy associated with success. In fact, they like a bit of an ostentatious flash of success from time to time. And so, I always found it much more welcoming in Asia to talk about entrepreneurship and to talk about success.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because actually just recently some of us have been talking in room about that sort of tall poppy syndrome, where particularly I would say in the UK, there's this sense that, you know, if you are more successful, that simply draws resentment, etc. Yet ironically, you know, on the other end, you know, people are always wanting to be successful. So I mean, it's an extraordinary dichotomy in terms of the, and sometimes contradiction around this sort of space. So Brandon, before I come on to you, actually, just one of the aspects that we talked about there then is sort of the barriers to supporting the growth of those SMEs, that aspirational entrepreneur. I mean, I'm non-exec on a fantastic digital disruptive business called Goodloop, which, Jeremy, I know I've introduced you to, 28-year-old entrepreneur, turning over $4 million a year, already done one round of investment, you know.
Amazing business. And raising money right now, if anybody wants to participate, yeah. Reach out to John. I think you'd probably help them, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, when I look at people like that, who is registered B Corp, is, you know, gone into it with an ethical purpose to transform and disrupt a business. And I have to say, you know, I've introduced them to Omnicom, and we're doing some great work for clients like Levi and Diageo and things. You know, what are the barriers? Because, you know, beyond finance, funny enough, the Winners Club this morning had Piers Linney, who's well known to many people as a former Dragon Den or Shark Tank investor. And Piers is creating something which actually helps create for SMEs access to technology, which otherwise is available for the bigger businesses, but hard for smaller businesses to actually access. And I wonder if we said, well, yes, access to technology, access to finance. Brandon, coming to you first, in your experience, what are the other barriers for helping smaller businesses scale, in your experience?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, you know, I did a 3-year research project with FTI out of Chicago, and we reverse engineered about 3,000 different industries that were going through disruption or had attempted to be consolidated. And I created these, what I call breakpoints across the spectrum of growth. And it seems like 100,000 to 3 million, and then 3 to 8 million, 8 to 15, 15, 25. And it just keeps going up until I tested it with the billion-dollar company that we went to four. And you know, the best analogy I can give is if any of us, not I shouldn't say any of us because I don't know your guys' skill set, but me, for example, if I was all of a sudden introduced to being a participant on Dancing with the Stars and I was on the first show, like, I would be a disaster. And if it was up to me by myself to get on the last show, I would never make it. And then you ask yourself, well, for those people that are on the first show, you can clearly see, like, I have three daughters. When I walk in, I can say, oh, those are the stars. These are the experts. But if I don't watch anything and I watch the last show, I have to ask my kids, because I'm not technically inclined enough to understand the difference between techniques and skill sets. The reason I bring that up is that when you go and identify how many people are working together behind the scenes to get a contestant from the first show to the last show, choreographing everything, training people, mental coaches, stretch coaches, physical conditioning, food, makeup, you know, you go through, and all those people are working together for one purpose. And that is to get the people who can not just survive, but thrive, to get to that last show so that the shows are interesting. And I think of entrepreneurs the same way. And so they technically don't have guidance and assistance. I've built my last three businesses with no money, just internally generating its own resources. This last one I started with Grant Cardone, I did 2.5 million in the first 6 months, and then 15 million last year, and I'll do 40 million this year. And I, neither one of us have put a dime in. I didn't put a dime in my last company. I think that the technical aspect of growing and in that startup, it's the what you do, and then it goes to who you do it with, and then it goes to how you do it, then it goes to the leadership, then it goes to the technologies, then it goes to the integration of technologies. It's like these things that have to happen to get to a billion, and there really isn't a resource, because in my experience, almost all business owners, as they grow and scale, are always hiring people up into where they need to put fires out. And they don't have the accessibility to the people that have that experience coming down to help them. They pick off consultants here or there, but usually it's very siloed or transactional. So to me, it's the development of the leadership skill set, the awareness of the entrepreneur, and the ability to drive awareness within the team. It's the financial acumen, really understanding the importance and significance of having really good data and clean books. And then it's about inspiring and motivating people to take action, because you know there's always going to be points where the business is difficult, it's hard, it could break. And it's in those nuances that your teams are there to catch the pieces and put them back together. And if you don't develop that team and you assume the people you hire will just do it, which is the fatal mistake of every entrepreneur, then they continually break. So in my mind, it's the four pillars of the business: marketing, operations, sales, finance, and people, and understanding how to integrate them at different life cycles of the business at different stages. And I just think that when we assist entrepreneurs and put that roadmap in front of them, they just slice right through it, because now they don't think about what they need to do. They take action on the things that will create the best result. And so to me, but you got to find business owners and entrepreneurs that aren't so ingrained that they're right and that their thing is the only thing they can do, because there's a lot of unaware business owners. And I always say your assets are your liabilities. The thing that got you to start it and make you great will become a liability and risk in the future. And if people can acknowledge that, accept it, and move through that, they'll succeed. If people don't, they'll withdraw. And that's been my experience.
Brandon, that's a masterclass there. And I have to say, for some of us who will never get and make XD millions of goodness knows what in 6 months, I know there'll be plenty of people in the audience thinking, how the heck does that happen? But what I'm encouraged by is the fact that actually when you go back to it, you talk about the four conventional business pillars, as you called them, and you talked about people. And actually then it's about, you know, having the clarity as an entrepreneur to be able to see what works from people like yourself and others and be able to apply that and not be so rigid. So I think that was fascinating. Ronnie, did you have something you want to add there?
Yeah, I totally agree with Brandon, but I do feel that small businesses have an unusually difficult time raising money when they need it. They're mainly dependent on bank finance. Bank finance usually requires assets as collateral. It's very rare that you can get cash flow type funding for a small business. And so the availability of equity in the way that, say, the Small Business Administration has made it available to small business in the United States is something that we haven't really tackled in Europe in the way that the US has done. And when you talk about emerging markets, Brandon, you have all of the challenges you're talking about, but you can't even raise the small amount of capital that you need to get started, the seed capital. And if we want to try and boost employment coming out of COVID, it seems to me, in addition to everything you say, which I think I totally agree with, we need to work on making funding of small businesses easier. Obviously, you know, you in your activities previously, John, you've made small amounts of money available to entrepreneurs who were starting from scratch through the Prince's Trust. We need to scale these efforts up, and they need to go beyond you know, the person starting a business from scratch. And wanting to have a sort of owner proprietor type, a business type of of setup, which you know can end up employing very small numbers of people. We need to bring money to entrepreneurs who'd like to build a small business that can employ you know, several people, perhaps tens of people, and medium-sized businesses grow out of that then to employ several hundreds.
You know, Ronnie, I just want to comment on that. 100% agree with you. Statistically, though, two-thirds of those businesses will fail cyclically every 5 years, and not because they didn't have access to capital here in the U.S. It's because they technically did not know how to deploy the capital or build the resources. So I truly believe that accessibility to capital, and we proved this when we launched our business internationally, and I agreed with Jeremy when I went to Singapore and Denmark, the old thought processes that were there, as soon as there was an awareness, there was another way to do it. We got massive traction, which was in Italy and Germany, which was wonderful to see that. So I don't disagree that accessibility to capital responsibly deployed can accelerate the success and growth of the business. But if you just look at the stats, capital isn't the thing in the U.S., and it is readily available to small, mid-sized businesses because two-thirds of them will still burn through it and fail and then lose their confidence to do it again. So if you have the combination of accessibility to capital with a business structure that allows SMBs to succeed, then you got a magic success ratio there that can add more employees in. You know, and that entrepreneurs will invest relative to their confidence level. That's what my experience has been.
That's an interesting point, Brandon, because if you think of venture capital, which is really bringing money and expertise to help an entrepreneur build a sizable business, which may start from scratch, but it has the ambition to be huge, that model doesn't exist for small businesses. You know, you can get finance, but it's very difficult to get mentors like yourself who can coach them on how to run their business.
Yeah. Well, I just noticed actually that Grant Cardone, actually, so Brandon, your business partner in this, and obviously well-known person, has just come in. I don't know, Grant, I don't know how long you've been there, so I don't know quite how much you've been listening to, but obviously we've got this discussion about the encouragement of entrepreneurialism around the globe and also creating value in all its senses, not just for the individuals, business owners, but also the value they put back into society. I wonder, Grant, do you have any thoughts on that? Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah. Well, John, first of all, when you say my name, I sound much more intelligent than when I say it.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't apologize, but I'll say that.
Grant, how do you say my full name again?
Well, I say Grant Cardone.
Yeah, you see, it sounds much better the way you say it. Good morning, everybody. So on Brandon's note, and Brandon, you ought to tell them about this webinar that we're going to do where we allow 25 small business owners come in and pitch their business for capital or collaboration or marketing, because even the companies that have a name, that have the capital, I'm sorry, like if nobody knows you and you can't get heard, you're just going to burn through capital. So, you know, one thing is, hey, can I get access to capital too? And Brandon can speak to this better than I can, but does anybody know me? Is there a demand for a product? And if there is a demand for the product, at the point where there is demand, then there's going to be a lot of players, and the player that's most known will end up with the most money. So we're going to do five webinars back to back where business owners can come in. We were talking about this last night, Brandon and I, over dinner. And this could be $1 million or $10 million company that come in and pitch their company, which solves one problem. Number one, I get known. Like, that has to happen first. The money, whether you have it or don't have it, you have to get known. This is what I discovered about 2007, 2008. Nobody knew me. I had a great idea, great product, great service. I'm a good guy. I work hard, but nobody knew me. So it just didn't matter. I'm going to burn through cash. So we're going to be offering people an opportunity to come up and first get known to a large audience. And number two, pitch to people that are qualified to either fund the business are collaborate and with intelligence, scaling, putting the right people in the right place. Brandon, you want to talk to that about that?
Yeah, and it goes to what we were just talking about, Ronnie and Jeremy, the whole accessibility to capital. But to Grant's point, what our experience has been, the business owners, they get capital. I mean, we had a lot of business owners that got PPP money last year, and then they blow through it making a lot of bad decisions versus learning how to promote themselves and grab attention, and then money will follow the attention. And so you have a lot of people that technically are inclined and then think that what they're going to do is going to be the driver of the business. And although that gets them started, then they tend to stall because all the other aspects of building a business. So we've broken those down, and we're going to do this webinar to explain to business owners, because I think it's an awareness and education issue. And if you bring the awareness and the education, people can accelerate their success.
Yeah. Grant, can I ask you a question? Do you find more of these businesses today, these small business owners who lack these skills and often lack capital too, are interested in business models that do well and do good at the same time, which is something we discussed earlier in this conversation? Because I see these businesses as being capable of contributing to their communities in a very significant way because of their, you know, the local nature very often. Do you sense anything has changed in this market in terms of impact?
So what is, I'm not clear on the question, actually.
Yeah, so I'll come in, Grant. So basically the sort of premise is that you have people, obviously, who will have a business idea, but many people are now creating a business idea that solves an issue for humanity with impact in a community, such as driving employment, so that rather than just about, I suppose, becoming more wealthy and making a small group of people create value out of the business, they're looking at the wider value of their business on society in some way. And what we're seeing in the UK and elsewhere particularly is a growth of things like the B Corp movement that came out of the States, where you've got a wave of entrepreneurs coming with a primary purpose, issue for humanity, measurable positive impact on the planet or on people. And we just wonder if that's something that you're seeing in your experience.
Well, I hear everybody interested in saving the world, but you know, most of these businesses fail. Like, let's face it, like 2/3 of all small businesses in America break even or lose money. You cannot change the world if you break even. Not for over long periods of time, unless you're going to get funding from Wall Street. And even that will not be tolerated at some point.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, I suppose, is, you know, and people's motivation for becoming successful in business, there's no two ways about it. It's to create value, it's to create wealth. I guess that what we've seen is a wave away from the Friedman philosophy of purely being about the shareholders to a more of a broader stakeholder return. This is not about becoming unprofitable at all, but I guess it's about being not sort of making money, then being philanthropic with the money, but it's actually the virtues that are in the business that are also solving issues, like Tesla, for example, you know, trying to address
I don't think that's a new thing. I think people have always been interested in making things better, you know. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but you know, I've never met anybody that wanted to do business just to make money. They thought for the most part they were doing something for the customer that provided some value add.
Yeah,
you know, like when we do these things, like what I was talking about earlier, this webinar, like that's not. Yeah, does that help me? Yes, it does. But we want to collaborate with other people, like you, John, like Sir Jeremy, like we want to collaborate with other people that have intelligence to help you build your audience. We build our audience. The good guys are going to win in the long term, particularly when they pull together, right? And so it's when, you know, Doctor and I do something together. Okay. When Dr. Amy and I do something together, all of a sudden both of our audiences get bigger.
Yeah. So, but in my book, Impact, I show Grant, that the world is actually shifting to business models, as John was saying, that improve lives or the planet. They might improve diversity, they might provide employment in low employment areas. They might, you know, improve the emissions because they're recycling businesses or something else. And today we're seeing massive capital flow. And I agree with you that there's a high mortality rate. Like, there's a high mortality rate in venture capital, but it's only, you know, probably 20 or 30% of companies that get venture capital backing in a good portfolio that will go bust. And it's the other way around with small businesses. What I mentioned in the book is that values have changed now. And if you want to give yourself the best chance of success as a small business or as a big business, then you have to do things that are consonant with the new values of preserving the environment and treating people properly. And if you do that, you can attract customers more easily, and you can attract talent more easily, and you can attract investors more easily. But from everything that that I see happening in the world today, you give yourself a better chance of being successful if you bring that additional dimension to it. The question of how do you reduce the mortality rate, I don't know how we scale that up. I agree with you, it's very high. There isn't the mentorship that goes with having a venture capitalist invest in you. So how do we scale it up? How do we improve?
Yes, we bring awareness. You know, the reason there's a mortality rate is because of awareness. And what Grant was talking about was, Grant attracts people that want to do good things, want to be bigger. That's his brand, right? So you get the trainers that want to help people become healthy. You get the doctors that want to help people get off pharmaceuticals and get into naturopathic stuff. So we do attract, and from that standpoint, we have a massive community that want to change the world. They're mission driven. So I want to make sure that you what Grant's saying is, from a practical aspect, even those mission driven people approach it technically incorrectly because they're more consumed by the mission than they are the awareness of how to actually execute to the mission. And I think the only way we scale it up is by making a choice to do things like this, communicate about it, and then maybe we should start an entrepreneurial fund as a group.
Well, Brandon, Ronnie, Jeremy, I think Ron's actually had to go now, but actually I think what this illustrates is a convergence. So a convergence of the way in which people, regardless of the initial motivation, need the same skill set. They need things like access to finance. They need the sort of access to people to grow their business. And, you know, to go back to what you were saying, Brandon, that expertise, that illustration of progress and growth over many years, that is a transferable, or rather that is available to anybody, whatever the motivation is. What Ronnie is talking about, is in my personal experience, and what Jeremy is seeing as well, is very much that we are having a much greater increase in flow through of people driven by the purpose of business, to be not just about making money, but about making value in the broadest sense. Now, what I want to do, if that's okay, is that we have got a whole load of people trying to get onto the stage to ask questions. I'm very much conscious of the time that we've had a fantastic discussion, but if you're happy, I'd like to give the chance to some others just to come up and ask the questions. I'm in the hands.
John, I just have to apologize because I'll have to go on the hour. But
right. Okay, it was a great conversation. but thank you so much for coming in. So, ladies and gentlemen, before Sir Ronald goes, please do click on his face and follow him. Jeremy, Brandon, if you're here to stay, we've got still some more time if you're happy to carry on the conversation. Would that be okay,
yeah,
Jeremy?
I'll stick around for another 10 minutes. Yeah, I have guests at home here now, so I should go and join them shortly. But Sir Ronald, it's been a real pleasure to meet you. Heard a lot about you.
Likewise.
Yeah, fascinating.
Likewise, and happy to cooperate and help. I mean, I think the problem that you've identified with small businesses is a real problem, and happy to put our heads together and see how we can bring scale to your solution.
Absolutely. And both Jeremy, Ronnie, it was a pleasure being on the stage with you, and I could stay on for 10 more minutes as well.
Okay, great. So Brian and Jeremy, thanks. Thank you so much. Thank you to the Winners Club. Thank you to Ashley, Paul, and James. To the rest of my good friends, the moderators, let's go forth and let's build those businesses, folks. Thanks very much, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Winners Club. If you have taken some practical lessons and learnings from some of the most impactful conversations on Clubhouse, then we would love your support for this show by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts.